From the Sky News Centre at 6, a state of emergency has been declared in Tunisia and the government dissolved as armed police fight running street battles with crowds. Protesters are angry about corruption, unemployment and high food prices. British tourists are being flown home from the country's resorts. The Foreign Office advises against further travel there. This man's relieved to have landed in Manchester.
We was confined to the hotel about the Wednesday. Out of the hotels, it was no-go zone. There were shootings and everything else, like, so from the stories we was receiving, it sounded very bad and was glad to sort of get out, really.
Well, within the last hour, Tunisia's president has reportedly left the country and the PM is apparently in power. In other news, a 14-year-old boy has been arrested after a petrol bomb was thrown during student protests. Yesterday, police appealed for help in releasing footage from the tuition fees demonstration in central London last month. The Yorkshire Ripper has lost a challenge at the Court of Appeal against his whole life tariff. It means Peter Sutcliffe, who murdered 13 women in the 70s and 80s, will never be freed. The driver of the number 30 bus, which was blown up in the 7-7 attacks, has praised the good spirit of Londoners on that terrible day. George Saradakis has told the inquest he remembers a loud bang and the windscreen shattering in Tavistock Square. 13 passengers were killed. He says he was overwhelmed at the carnage.
When I am asked to talk about the 7th of July, immediately come to my mind all those innocent fellow citizens who lost their lives in such a gruesome and barbaric way going about their legitimate business.
There could potentially be problems ahead for petrol deliveries. Thousands of tanker drivers are to be balloted for industrial action in a row over pay and working conditions. A British judo expert has been formally awarded one of Japan's highest honours. 73-year-old George Kerr from Edinburgh has received the Order of the Rising Sun at a ceremony in the Scottish capital. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
BCFM Travel News. In association with the Global Traffic Network, supported by the Highways Agency.
In Dorset, the A31 is closed. It's closed in both directions near Stirminster Marshall because of an accident which happened at Stag Gate. Recovery is underway, but the road does remain closed and there is very slow traffic in the area. It's affecting the A350 as well, which is queuing all the way back to the A35 Upton Bypass. In Wiltshire, the A36 going into Salisbury on the Wilton Road, that's looking busy towards the St Paul's roundabout, and going west from Salisbury towards Wilton, the A36 is heavy between the Park Wall traffic lights and the A30 Wilton roundabout. The A417 in Gloucestershire is busy as you go north down the hill from the Birdlip turning towards the Air Balloon roundabout. Both the M4 and the M5 are running well through the region now, just been checking on motorway cameras. If you're either going into South Wales on the westbound M4, traffic slow through Newport from junction 24, the Caldra, through towards the Bryn Glass tunnels. I'm Chris Wood.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time. Well, coming up, an exclusive interview with former federal prosecutor John Loftus, who has a new book out just this January called America's Nazi Secret. We'll be hearing from him about recently declassified information in the US on Britain's royal Nazi agents. But first, as Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance heads into 2011, we hear from National Vice President of the Civil Service Union, PCS, John McAnally. How is John planning to fight the cuts? Hi, John, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
Now, first question really is, what is the PCS, the union that you represent?
It's a civil service union. It represents workers in all parts of central government services like job centres, tax, passports, all the services that we need in society. We also have a commercial sector where we have private sector workers, but generally that's who we represent.
What sort of private sector workers are you representing? Is this sort of office workers?
Yeah, in some cases it is. IT workers, cleaners, anybody, really people whose jobs have been privatised, or companies who are operating central government contracts.
Now, for a lot of people, especially young people today, they think of unions as these sort of dinosaurs that nearly brought the country to its knees back in the early 1980s.
Yeah. And of course that's nonsense. Unions are the best organisations we can possibly have in order to not just defend jobs and conditions, but to also and defend us against the big corporations, the privatisations that are taking place. And that is why our union, I'm not saying we're the only one, but out of many, we took an absolutely clear stand on the cuts. Our policy is no cuts and no privatisation, that no cuts are actually necessary in the sixth richest country in the world. The cuts are ideological, they're about cutting in the public sector. And from that point of view, we will do our best to stop them in alliance with other unions and community groups.
Now, you've got a bit of a problem on your hands, haven't you? Because you're a democratic union, you have your policies elected by your membership, but hang on a minute, the cabinet is democratically elected too. So which one is really democratic? I know you're going to say the unions, aren't you?
What I'm actually going to say is the union tells the truth and the politicians spin, because nobody, none of the major parties went into their general election only 8 months ago or so and told them about the scale of the cuts. It was all about, well, we've got to trim this and we've got to do that. Cameron himself said any minister that came to him to take away frontline services would be shown the door. And it's turned out we're now facing, I think we have to understand the scale of what we're talking about. These cuts that are taking place, the nearest possible comparison is not with the 80s Thatcher, or even the 40s, or rather the 30s. You have to go right back to the early 20s to the Geddes report to see cuts in the public sector on this scale. They are catastrophic. They will change people's lives, millions of people's lives. They will strip out the services that our communities need and deserve, and will turn us from they will put us in a position where the country is less civilised. It will be dog eat dog, and the most vulnerable will go to the wall. We really are talking about a potential catastrophe if we don't stop it.
Well, what many Conservatives will say is that some people are just not, these are the people who may be taking more than their fair share of public services, are just not contributing enough to society.
Well, let me give you an example on that. Let's talk about the big furore about benefit fraud that it goes on, and our members administered benefit. Benefit fraud would represent something like 1% of the amount of money that's lost in tax evasion and avoidance and uncollected tax. 3/4 of the national debt could be paid off if we collected the tax, if we stopped tax avoidance and tax evasion. Really, all this stuff about either it's lazy public sector workers or people getting something for nothing, it's a smokescreen. What this is about is about the big multinational companies coming in, tearing apart the public services, trying to get profit out of what areas they can, and everything else can just go to the wall. So, we'll hear all sorts of propaganda. The fact of the matter is, we have a cabinet of millionaires. We have a cabinet, actually. I think it's 23 out of 29 of them are millionaires. Let me tell you just something about George Osborne. Now, this is a guy who's telling us we're all in it together and there's no alternative. He's a beneficiary of a £4 million trust fund, which means that his family fortune will pass to him almost tax-free. And he'll be reported to save something like £1 million in inheritance tax. Now, from that point of view, I think, George, don't tell us we're all in it together, because obviously some are doing better than others. Let me just make this last point. There are people sitting in their homes tonight terrified about what's going to happen this year. They may lose their jobs. How are they going to pay their mortgages, educate their children? But Bob Diamond, the Barclays chief, could walk into a House of Commons a committee just during the week, a man earning millions upon millions of pounds, and say that the
Yeah, we had him on earlier on, yes.
Yeah, and saying there's no need to say sorry. And, there's something seriously wrong in those kind of standards. And I think our union's position of no cuts and no privatisation, I think 6 months ago was regarded as a fundamentalist and eccentric. It is now becoming the only obvious answer. This stuff about the national debt, I know we've got an economist here, this stuff about the national debt is a load of baloney. A national debt is only the sign of an active economy. If you didn't have a national debt, you'd actually be worried. And the deficit was caused by the bankers driving the economy into recession. All it really happens, all a national debt is a relationship between what's actually coming in tax. And from that point of view, in a recession caused by the bankers, you get less coming in tax, you've got to pay out more in welfare, and that will even itself out. But the way you don't do it, as we see, to paraphrase the song, if you go across the sea to Ireland, you'll see the catastrophe of an austerity programme which will only drive the economy further into recession. The way to get out of the recession is to create jobs, is to invest in the public sector, is to invest in private industry as well. I'll tell you what the big problem is. The banks won't lend. They're sitting on billions of pounds of our money, by the way. Our money, we gave them £1.4 trillion. They haven't paid it back. They're sitting on £860 billion in bank assets. If George wants to clear the national debt, he can write a cheque tonight and clear it.
But I mean, what you were saying earlier about George Osborne, I mean, this is just tax avoidance, isn't it? There's nothing illegal about it. It's tax evasion. I mean, you could pay maybe a couple of £100 to a solicitor to give you a little bit of advice, or to an independent financial advisor. Anybody can do that, not just George.
No, not anybody can do it. I can't pay a financial advisor because I earn something like 23. I'm happy to say this as my job as an executive officer in the civil service. I earn something like £23,000 a year because I can't employ a tax advisor, so not everybody can actually do that. But you see, leave aside the morality of this, and it's utterly immoral that a millionaire banker actually pays proportionately less tax than the woman, and it usually is a woman who cleans his flat. It's bad economics. If everybody was paying their fair share, then you can fund the public services 10 times, 100 times over. So leave aside the morality of it. It is bad economics. And that is why we say, amongst other things, there should be what's called a Tobin tax or a Robin Hood tax on financial transactions. And when we say financial transactions, we're not talking about when we go to take money out of a cash point. What we're talking about is the big financial transactions between banks. That could raise £20 billion in this country alone. Internationally, it could raise £400 billion. You could put an end to poverty in 20 years across the globe, let alone in this country, if we had decent taxation. So you don't even need to have a revolution. You could do that even under capitalism. So these people are, I have to say this, they're spinners, they are liars, and they're not fit to hold office. They lied to the British people, and of course I have to say that the Labour Party and the Liberals, clearly they all agree there's got to be cuts. They're all talking nonsense.
Let's get this straight, John, because before the general election they were actually elected, the LibCon Alliance, at least the Conservatives, who got the biggest share of the vote, were elected on the concept that they were going to put the country's finances in order, and that's not going to be an easy task.
Well, if somebody says they're going to put my household finances in order, and I would agree to that. If they didn't give me the detail, I think I would like to know what the detail is. If they said putting the finances in order was coming around and burning down my house so the whole problem was removed, which is really what these people are doing, they didn't tell us the truth. And a lot of us, like activists like myself, knew what was coming. The average man or woman in the street didn't. They may have had a worry about it, but the reality is, he just said, no, we're going to get the debt sorted out. They talk about we can't bequeath a debt to future generations, but what would be worse than bequeathing a debt? Which is, incidentally, just for your listeners, the deficit is actually falling now. And that is even a result of the very mild, mild measures that the last Labour government put in terms of quantitative easing.
Well, this is since May last year. You know, that what has happening is the Conservatives are already bringing that deficit down. They're doing what they said they would do before the election.
The deficit in November actually started to go up again.
Yeah,
and I think one of the problems is, to get to the root of this, is that you can't cut your way out of a deficit, which is the implication of what you were saying. I mean, we've seen the Irish trying to do this, and they've just dug themselves into a hole. And what happened after the election was that both Cameron and Clegg said, we didn't promise as swinging cuts as you're going to get, but we've now got this crisis in Greece, and if we don't do what we get, it's an emergency now, everything we said before the election have to go out the window. We've got a crisis in Greece, we're going to end up like Greece if we don't cut now. And that was the line they were taking. But when we had a Conservative on here last week and we were talking about Ireland, and he said, oh, we're not like Ireland. And what obviously you think about these things after this, but we are like Greece. We're not like Ireland, but we are like Greece. Mm. And I would say, actually, we are like Ireland and Greece. That is to say that cuts will not reduce the deficit. They will have all the negative impacts that you're talking about, but they won't reduce the deficit.
Absolutely.
And the other thing I'd mention, of course, PCS represents tax collectors, and they're being cut back.
Well, could I make a point on that?
Yeah.
One of the first things that this government done when they came in, there was a specialist unit in HMRC in Inland Revenue, which is quite a small unit. And what they do is they collect tax from millionaires, very effective small unit that was bringing in millions. What did Cameron do when he came in? They closed that unit in order to move those people onto processing, because he'd cut jobs in processing. A compliance officer in HMRC can collect in 1 year £658,000. What they do, and they're cutting compliance officers. So it is insanity on a grand scale.
Benefit officers basically have to be subsidised. They do succeed in getting some benefits, benefit fraudsters, but their jobs have to be subsidised. At the end of the day, there isn't a lot of money to get. Tax officers pay for themselves.
That's exactly the point I was making earlier, when 1% of benefit fraud benefit fraud would represent 1% of tax avoidance. But of course, it's good for politicians to go on and bash the feckless and the workshy and so on, and they create. I would go as far, this might sound like strong language, but in this country, what we're seeing is what could only be described as a hate campaign against the public sector and against people on benefit, disabled people. We will see disabled people, people with multiple sclerosis, people with various problems who deserve support, ground into the dust if the disability changes go through. And who is it waiting in the sidelines to pick up the privatisation? It's the same American companies that try to stop Obama bringing in healthcare in the United States. The people who are running our government, sorry to use strong language, they are barbarians. And from that point of view, they've lied to people. They're all up to their neck in money, and they're in the hands of the big private companies.
What they'll say, John, is that we're simply trying to get the house in order. We're simply trying to get the books balanced.
No, I mean, can I say first of all that this idea you can run an economy in the same way that you run a household, it's about balancing the books at the end of the month. It's economic illiteracy, and from that a point of view, let me give you one example. I mean, these are not our figures, these are the Treasury figures. As a result of these austerity measures, they're talking about cutting 1.3 million jobs. Now, we've heard all this propaganda saying that the private sector have had it hard, we've got to support them. But 600,000 of those jobs would be public sector jobs. 700,000 would actually be private sector jobs, because every time you cut a public sector job, at least one goes in the private sector, and it's probably two, and at least three are impacted upon. And from that point of view, that this idea that public spending is a debt, it's money down the drain, it's just nonsense. It's an investment in the economy as well as an investment in people and services. And that's why our union today, I'd just like to tell you, because we got some news in today, we've just balloted our members. It's not an industrial action ballot, I have to stress that. It's what we call a policy ballot. And there were two questions on it. One was about the government's attempt to legislate and steal our accrued rights under the compensation scheme. It's about redundancy payments. But let's leave that to one side. The second question was whether our members endorsed the union's campaign to oppose the cuts. We're the first union to actually do that. We got a 96% approval, a 96% yes vote.
Well, certainly the results in yesterday's by-election would say to indicate that the wider public, also certainly up in Oldham and Saddleworth, would agree with that, because they Labour came back with quite a largely increased majority, and the Conservative vote was way down.
If Ed Miliband, I have to say, one of his first comments when he got elected was to talk about unreasonable strikes, and to endorse the idea that cuts are necessary. But if Ed Miliband put his thinking cap on and applied some of the principles that actually were the foundation of the Labour Party and simply say, yes, we believe in the public sector, yes, we believe that, that there should be no cuts, yes, we should rein in the big corporations. Ed Miliband would be elected on a landslide in this country. But he's dithered and he's saying he's going to have a policy review. The fact of the matter is the Labour Party or the new Labourites still are in hock to the big companies.
Well, if I can just quote Ed from this morning, John and Martin, I'd actually like Martin to respond to this. Ed Miliband, leader of the Labour Party, said this morning, I think part of what it should be about in this country is listening to the voters. Now, I find quite surprising to say part of what it should be about.
I think
that is what David Cameron and Nick Clegg should do. Martin, you know, this isn't really fighting talk, is it?
No, and I think the problem is that we need a proper debate within the Labour movement about what the correct strategy is. I think it's quite interesting in the Labour leadership election campaign. I was very surprised and interested to see that Ed Balls, who was on the right of the party, saying perhaps what we need is a whole new generation of council housing, not cuts at all. Andy Burnham, who was always thought of as a Blairite, said, well, maybe what we have to look at is rebooting the tax system and bringing in things like land value taxation.
Yes, but you put your money on Ed Miliband, Martin, didn't you? You were quite open about that.
But I actually voted for Diane Abbott and Ed Miliband as my second choice. I'd probably have voted for John McDonald if he'd been on the ballot, but he wasn't. And I think we've got, you know, that politics is the art of the possible. We've had a whole generation of free market nonsense. And people have grown up with it. And therefore, and don't forget the Tory press is out there. And if you change tack and say, well, we don't want any cuts at all, the Tory press will then go screaming at you. Now, I'm not saying that they shouldn't change direction, but you can understand why they're timid about it, because they haven't got the intellectual power of people like Dennis Healy used to have in the past. He would have just turned around and said, no, this is all wrong. I think that these people are actually, they're learning through experience. And what's going to happen before the end of the year is that the deficit is going to be bigger and the economy is going to be on the floor. The government will be on the ropes, and at that point we won't be talking about cuts at all. Events will force it.
We would welcome the Labour Party fighting the cuts. Now, I understand the point you make about the Tory press, but you start from telling the truth. There is absolutely no need for any cuts whatsoever. I mean, our policy, we've set out an alternative strategy. Let me run through it very, very quickly. Well, I've made the points about the national debt and so on. The alternative is based on tax justice, which we've had some discussion about. We should create 1 million climate jobs. We will see the effects of a global warming. That would not only stimulate the building industry, it would be a damn good investment for the future. Instead of cutting housing benefit and socially cleansing our inner cities, we should build 1 million council homes. Now, none of that is extreme radical socialism. It's just good common sense. And even if that was done, and even at this stage, your Labour Party doesn't put that forward. But I'll tell you where the problem's going to come. And this is something that's going to have to be faced by the anti-cuts movement and the unions itself. You cannot say no to Tory cuts, but it's okay if Labour councils implement them. That is going to be the big fault line. And let me tell you what's happened as far as that's concerned. We've now seen, I think, a tremendous thing in the Labour movement, the election of Len McCluskey for Unite, the union. I think that is, you know, we in PCS absolutely welcome that. He's came out along with our General Secretary, Mark Cervoka, and he's saying he's going to support and lead, in fact, the anti-cuts movement. Now, industrial action, I'll tell you this, I'll be as clear as this, industrial action is absolutely inevitable, not possible, it's inevitable, and it may be sooner rather than later if the government doesn't step back. Let me tell you, I'll give you one example on pensions. We know they want to put our pensions up, they know they want us to pay more, but what people out there don't realise yet is that this arbitrary non-negotiated change from the retail price index to the cost price index is going to, over the course of the years, for a large number of pensions of ordinary people, cut pensions, devalue them by between 15% and 25%, and that will hit particularly hard on women workers. Now the TUC is calling a meeting at the end of January to talk about not only coordinating the campaign but coordinating industrial action. If they press ahead with this on pensions, I don't think it is our demand, actually we posed this at the TUC, that there should be joint industrial action. And even those unions or union leaderships, to be more precise, who have been a bit hesitant in the past, are faced with a stark choice. You either fight these people or we go down. It is as simple as that. So from that point of view, we take the view that yes, industrial action and unions are important, but we have to build in the communities as well.
But John, I mean, if Thatcher years are anything to go by, you're going to fight them and you're going to go down.
No, I mean, I don't accept that. I mean, I was around in the Thatcher years, and you know, we could have a long discussion about why there were failures there with the miners and the printers and so on. But the real thing here is about effective leadership, and the problem we have in this country is that there is no effective political leadership. You know, that all the main parties talk about cuts, all the main parties are in hock one way or another to the big multinationals, but people are getting fed up. I mean, if you look at what's happening in this country, we have seen young people who were supposed to be apathetic and non-political, and they took to the streets. And you know, kids as young as, I've got a 15-year-old, kids as young as that, who are saying to their parents, working class kids who are coming to their parents, that has been said to me by my own son, is I don't think I can afford to go to university. Now, whether he can or not, I don't know. But the fact, I grew up in the East End of Glasgow, which, you know, without doing the old Yorkshireman sketch from Monty Python, was quite it was quite a poor area. And I managed to get a really, really good free education. And what kind of society is it that's now going to privatise education and stop the vast bulk of people getting access to free education? There will be an almighty battle over that. And the youth have shown the way, the students have shown the way, that they're asking the question, where are the unions? Well, some of us have been fighting all our lives, but I think the unions are now going to come into the scene with a big bang over the coming period.
Yes, but I think the thing is, John, that we've got ranged against you, you've got a very determined Conservative Condem alliance. And you've got, of course, the financial sector and the big corporations. Really, the unions are minnows in comparison. And I mean, to take on these big guys, surely, I mean, it's almost as suicidal.
Well, I remember back in 2005 when it was in the Labour government trying to come and take away our pensions. Our union view was absolutely clear that we'd protect the pensions of existing members. There were some changes made for people coming in afterwards. And from that point of view, we stuck together with the other unions. We never even had to have a strike. An industrial action ballot alone managed to change the government's mind. Can I just make a point, Tony, on this idea? This is a strong government. No, it's not. The fact of the matter is, I remember the Thatcher years, and David Cameron is not Thatcher. And the fact of the matter is that the Liberal Party, I thought, I only caught up in the vote in Oldham just an hour or two ago. I think that flattered the Liberals. I think we'll see Liberal councils go down like ninepins in the unitary elections that are coming up. But all I would say is, no, it's not Thatcher. They are shaky. They have got big problems. And senior economists, even from the Federal Reserve in America, which is hardly the hotbed of socialism, has told them that they go down this road, they'll end up in the same state that Ireland has.
So can you point to any recent confrontation you've had with the employers that you've actually won?
What we've done over the course of the past 10 years, our leadership, you know, we've got General Secretary Mark Servock and our President Janice Gordon, we've had what you would describe as a socialist leadership in the union elected for 10 years. Have we won everything? Indeed we have not. We've taken some some detriments over the years, but we work on this simple principle. If you don't campaign they'll walk all over you. And because we have campaigned and taken industrial action as a last resort when necessary, we've managed to defend many things that would have gone otherwise. That is, and that's an absolute.
But can you give me a concrete example?
I've just given you one. Pensions is one. Well, we're fighting them on the civil service compensation scheme. The last government and this government thought they could walk in and just take away our redundancy rights.
What is the compensation scheme?
Well, the compensation scheme, yes. Sorry, it's a bit of a technical term. It's actually the amount of redundancy pay that civil servants would get if they were made, if they actually lost their jobs. So from that point of view, we are still fighting. We've been fighting. We had 3 days of strike action last March. We won 2 major victories in the High Court. When this lot came to power, they knew we'd won those victories. The victory actually was something quite simple. It basically said that accrued rights, which is simply the money you accumulate over the years through your job, and of course civil servants are very low paid people, that shouldn't be taken away without negotiation. They've decided to legislate to take it away, and they can drive through that legislation, but that opens them up to billions of pounds in compensation under European law. So we'll continue to fight them. But the key thing we've always done, we've always informed our members, we always have democratic discussion, we tell members that the absolute unvarnished truth, this is going to be difficult, and if we saved everything, no, but what we've managed to do is save quite a lot, and we haven't allowed them to walk all over us.
Right, we're going to have a little bit of music in a minute, but before that, Martin, you went down to the BBC programme, didn't you, when there was a discussion with some of the business community around Bristol about the wisdom or otherwise of public sector cuts. Can you just tell us what happened there?
Well, John was there, so he'll remember. I mean, it was BBC debate on the cuts, and it was presented in a very, very biased way. It was, we all know there's got to be cuts. What cuts shall there be? Will it be cuts number one from John Savage, cuts number two from somebody else who's a businesswoman, American businesswoman, and cuts number three from Lansdowne of Hargreaves Lansdowne.
Yeah. And I can remember just the week before, actually, the Director General of the BBC, Mark Thompson, was photographed going into Downing Street with a little list of various things, and one of those wonderful photographs where there's such a good lens on the camera that you can see exactly what he was talking to.
You know
to
the way they're playing this? They're saying that all major political parties in Britain were in favour of cuts before the election, therefore we all agree there will be cuts. What will they be? And that, of course, was the Labour Party selling the pass, because they shouldn't have agreed that there was going to be cuts. But you've got to remember that the Labour Party is itself a broad church. I mean, if there was a PR system, you'd probably have 2 Labour parties, as you've had in New Zealand or in Ireland, for example. Now, the fact is that there's a stranglehold on people's minds, and we've got to break this stranglehold. But I think this year we will break the stranglehold. And you know what's going to be the complete vulnerability for them? The deficit is getting bigger as a result of their cuts.
Absolutely.
Standard & Poor's and the ratings agencies are saying, because you are cutting, we're going to mark down your credit rating. And it could well be that before the end of this year, both the UK and the US will lose their credit rating because of the cuts. Not because the cuts aren't big enough, because of the cuts. And at that point, they will be in complete intellectual disarray. Of course, the ordinary folk will then suddenly wake up and realise that they've been completely hoodwinked.
Well, I think the ordinary folk have woken up. The real problem we have in this country is the failure of political representation. And that, I mean, that could open up a big debate in the Labour Party. But the fact of the matter is, when the youth and the students come onto the streets, then in the way that they did, that is a sign of real anger. It's a sign of real anger. And the unions must now, and they will, go behind that. And
I think the model is not so much Greece as in France, where people go to the streets together, united as generations, united as workers and unemployed and pensioners. And the difference between Greece and France is, in France, they win.
Given that there is a decent political alliance against these cuts, we're going to be finding out in a minute what the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance is going to do about it after this.
For the man to come, she lives in town.
from 1978. That's Gordon Lightfoot, Daylight Katie. I suppose in the build-up to the Winter of Discontent, maybe. But anyway, we're back now with John McAnally, who's the National Vice President of the PCS Trade Union. Now, John, you're part of the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance. Who is the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance?
Well, the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance was one of the first anti-cuts alliances to be formed in the country, and it's a very vibrant and effective organisation. It was initially started by PCS and the National Union of Teachers, along with other unions. We were getting other unions involved. We want to work with other unions, the Southwest TUC and the community organisations. I mean, you may remember we actually organised a demonstration in October. I think it was on the 26th of October. But however, proportionally speaking, it was the biggest demonstration in the country, actually, if you go by population. And a very successful demonstration. We organise various groups in various areas in terms of, for example, civil service, public services, health, and you know, groups who would discuss these issues, who would discuss what needs to be done. We have a democratic structure, and I simply think that if we don't take the fight into the communities, which we are doing, then we're going to have problems. But all the signs are that, like the poll tax struggle in the late 80s, that's when I came to live in Bristol, actually, got straight involved in the poll tax battle as I was in Scotland. And once, if you like, I use the expression ordinary people who normally wouldn't be in politics, start getting involved, then I think the days of the cuts are numbered.
So is it a trade union?
It's not a trade union. It's an alliance of all different organisations, trade unions, community organisations mainly.
And do they affiliate to you, yeah, or something? And what's the structure, basically?
Well, the structure is quite ad hoc at the present time. It's fairly loose. We do have group officers and a steering committee. But we actually had a meeting last night in East Bristol where around about, I think I would say about 60 or 70 people attended from all walks of life, all people who want to stop the cuts. We move forward on a democratic and consensual basis. And kind of just an announcement, Tony, for tonight, we will be calling a demonstration in Bristol on the 19th of February. And that is just the Saturday before the council does its budget. And, you know, our view is a very simple one, that no cuts from central government, no Tory cuts, no cuts from anybody.
OK, now, the big question is, what are you going to do? It's all very well going out in the street and demonstrating, but what can you actually do?
Well, what can we? Well, there's a number of ways you can influence things. There's, if you like, the obvious things like strikes, there's things like demonstrations. It's bringing people together. It's about forming opinions. It's a lot of the process of beating something, whether it's a poll tax or the cuts, is actually informing people there is actually an alternative. It's exposing the nonsense and the lies of the politicians. But I think more than anything else, it's giving people confidence. It's that ability. We hear that dreadful word empowerment used in a lot. Usually in relation to advertising something. But it really is about bringing people together and a common interest. And when people, as they are beginning to do, realise the full scale of these cuts, they will fight them. And the problem the government's got is they won't just be fighting activists, they'll be fighting, if you like, you know, the broad mass of the population. Can I just make this just one last point? The broad mass of people in this country, working class and middle class, are far to the left in their social attitudes and general attitudes than any of the major political parties. That's a fact. It's not an opinion that I'm simply expressing. Opinion poll after opinion poll proves that.
I was just thinking, how do people get in contact with the Bristol
the Anti-Cuts Alliance? Yeah.
I mean, there's no website at the moment or anything like that.
We've actually just produced a website. So if people have got computers, which most people have nowadays, if they input Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, they should find it. They'll also be advertised on Bristol Indie Media. If you're a trade union member. Have you asked your trade union rep? Now, I have to say that, no, all unions are affiliated to at the present time. But as you know, people find it. You know, I mean, it's actually there, and you know, it does get quite a lot of publicity.
Now, Martin, you're a bit of a strategist. Have you got any advice for John about how he should fight the cuts?
John is paid to be a strategist. I'm just a commentator. I think this is quite right. I think people are going to realise quite quickly that the people in charge either A, don't know what they're doing, or B, don't have their best interests at heart, and possibly both. I think the fact that they are incompetent is going to be the thing that's really going to strike home to people, that they don't actually know what they're doing. They don't actually have to take a cut strategy at the moment. Britain's actually got some leeway. Other countries are being screwed into the floor. Britain's got more room. Of course, the answer, ultimately, what will happen, I think, is we're going to have a crash, because we had a Labour government in this country, because even the Republicans in the US intervened to prop up the banks 2 years ago. People then think that the crisis was over. What was protecting you from the crisis was the public sector. That is about to be taken away, and the crisis will hit, and it will be worse than the 30s, because the linkages are so much greater now between different economies. So the kind of crash we're going towards is absolutely catastrophic. I'm afraid we're not going to be able to get out of this crash, because one way or another it's got to happen.
Well, Gus MacDonald is the Cabinet Secretary, has actually called on George Osborne to make sure he's got a plan B.
I don't think they have got a plan B. If they wouldn't be going down the road they're on if they had a plan B. They don't know what they're doing. I mean, what happens in economics is, over generations, there is changes of mood and of understanding. And what's happened, which most of the political leadership, Labour, Liberal and Conservative, haven't taken on board, is that everything that happened in Britain since 1979 was wrong. It's all wrong. And it's very hard for them to take it. They've lived their whole lives believing that all this free market stuff was right. But I was taught economics at Oxford University in the late 70s, and we were taught all about this free market stuff in lesson number one. And in lesson number two, we were taught why it was a load of rubbish. The problem with the people in charge is they've only absorbed lesson one, and lesson one's wrong.
Yes, but the trouble is, Martin, as the coffers run out, we have to do things like privatise the post office.
The coffers aren't run out. We're actually a much wealthier society than we were in 1979. It's all in the hands of private vested interests, and that's got to change. The idea that you can't take money off one person and give it to another person because that's wrong, well, that's just ideology. In the Second World War, in the Korean War, when the national survival's at stake, it's get your checkbooks out time for the wealthy classes. And of course they don't want to hear that, but they're a tiny minority, and they will get their checkbooks out because they won't have any alternative.
Well, one final question for you, John. At these demonstrations, quite often there is violence. How on earth do you, as the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance, make sure that that's kept to a minimum?
Well,
it's part of your responsibility, if you're involved in organising demonstrations, to make sure there isn't violence.
Well, one of the best ways of avoiding violence is to make sure there's a hell of a lot of people on the demonstration.
That's right. Look at the Iraq war demo. 2 million people,
That's actually properly stewarded. But we have to speak honestly here. We held the demonstration on the 23rd, I think it's the 23rd or 26th of October, and the violence was started by the police actually attacking or trying to rip away a banner which they claimed had, well, not claimed, I did have what, I don't know if I can use the word on the radio, an offensive word, and that was an over that's an overreaction. I have to say, generally speaking, that the Bristol police have been okay, but in London just a while back we witnessed what was little more than a police riot. And the idea of kettling, which is that this tactic used to be applied to football supporters, is false imprisonment. And what we saw in London, yes, there were some people throwing bottles and that they were behaving in a way...
And actually a fire extinguisher, which could have killed somebody.
Can I just say something? I agree. And we do not approve of anybody using violence. But I have to say, in terms of that lad, an 18-year-old who done something very, very, very stupid... But let's be clear, he was given 3 years, and that was nothing more than an act of judicial vengeance. And as far as that, I think that is absolutely outrageous. But there's a very interesting comment made by a senior police officer. He said that the 144 people arrested in London were all students. They weren't, if you like, you know, the so-called infiltrators and everything else. And he made a very interesting point. He said this is a life-changing experience for for them. So when you get ordinary, decent people ending up in those kind of situations and their lives being changed, then what actually happens is people, that actually feeds in a discontent. So as many people, but what we cannot have is political policing where they try to stop people demonstrating. And from that point of view, we don't approve of violence. We certainly don't approve of it. But from that point of view, the police have to behave in a rational and proper fashion as well.
Okay, can you tell us whereabouts you're meeting and when on the 19th of February?
Well, we haven't finalised any details, you know, but there will be a demonstration. Obviously, we'll speak to the police and the council and everybody else. But you know, we just say there should be no political policing. And what I mean by that is trying to stop people from demonstrating and using, overly heavy tactics. Of course, you've got to maintain the rule of law. At least that's what they say. But the rule of law is not police attacking demonstrations.
John McAnally, Vice President of the PCS Union, and Martin Summers, thank you very much. Now, he's one of the most celebrated Nazi hunters of all time, but almost unheard of here in Britain. Could that be because much of what he uncovered in the US intelligence vaults is deeply embarrassing for the British state and the royal family in particular? Last night, I spoke to former US Army officer and FBI special prosecutor under Jimmy Carter, John Loftus. I was intrigued to hear that he had discovered connections between British intelligence, MI5, MI6 and the London bombers, and their World War II predecessors, the Muslim Brotherhood. But I began by asking him about America's Nazi Secret, his new book.
My name is John Loftus. I'm a former federal prosecutor. Before then, I was an Army officer. And I've been for 30 years under security restrictions about what I could write. And now the classification clock has expired. And I was able to write a book called America's Nazi Secrets that includes all the stuff that's been censored out of my other 7 books the last 30 years.
Okay, so what kind of stuff's in there that wasn't in the previous books?
Oh, there's a good bit. I mean, all of the material about the Vatican, how they helped smuggle the Nazis and the Nazi money out of Europe after the war, the American and British role in wiretapping each other's citizens without search warrants. So each side can truthfully swear they're not spying on their own people. They're not. They're just trading information with each other. A really clever scheme, and I had access to the Attorney General's files that really showed exactly how they concealed the secret relationship with the British from Congress, and I assume the British have done the same thing with Parliament.
Are you saying that you think that there actually were... The Nazis successfully managed to sort of regroup after the Second World War? I mean, you know, what was actually going on in the late 1940s, early 50s?
Well, in the late 1940s, the British Secret Service established a policy of reviving pre-war British intelligence networks in Eastern Europe and in the Middle East. And many of these people had collaborated with the Nazis during World War II. But the British argument was, look, these chaps might have fought with the Germans in the last war, but they're not really Nazis. They're really anti-communist freedom fighters. Now, unfortunately for the gullible Americans who swallowed this line, the British guy who sold us the freedom fighters was a chap by the name of Kim Philby, and he was the highest-ranking communist spy ever to penetrate the British Secret Service. So instead of getting freedom fighters, we ended up with the dregs of the Nazi war criminals. Now, granted, the UK and Canada got far, far more than we did. We only got the tail end of it. But for the last 3 decades, the British government has absolutely censored out any mention of this material. The Windsors, you know, King Edward, you know, his mistress, Wallace Simpson, the American, was really a major Nazi agent, and she co-opted him. I saw the Justice Department top secret files where J. Edgar Hoover considered Windsor such a dangerous Nazi agent, he didn't even want him interned in the Bahamas during the war. He wanted him imprisoned where he could keep an eye on him. And in fact, one of your famous British historians, Anthony K. Brown, called me and begged me not to mention that the once king was a Nazi collaborator. And my reply was that the people of England didn't fight World War II to make England safe for Nazi retirement. So the British readers will find a lot of particular interest. I think the most amazing story is the Arab Nazi network. It started in Egypt in 1928. The Muslim Brotherhood were devout admirers of the Third Reich. In heaven, Allah, on earth, Hitler. And they had 750,000 members during World War II, and they promised General Rommel that he wouldn't find a single British or American soldier alive by the time they reached Cairo. What I'm seeing is that there is a heresy in Islam called Salafism, in Saudi Arabia it's called Wahhabism, that were pro-Nazi, and that the old Muslim Brotherhood of the old Nazi network grew up and split off and became Hamas and Al-Qaeda and all the extremists. Islam is a very peaceful, moderate faith. What we have with the Salafists is a heresy against Islam. And what history has been withheld is that it is a Nazi heresy, that the Nazis organized this religious campaign during World War II, and the British Secret Service hired the Muslim Brotherhood after World War II to crush the infant state of Israel. When that failed, the Muslim Brotherhood were eventually booted out of Egypt by the new secular government under Nasser, and Philby successfully conned the Americans into taking over his Arab Nazi networks. And so we used the Arab Nazis as sort of a proxy army during the Cold War to fight the Arab commies.
And don't you think that there's some parallels with the U.S. using Muslim networks in Afghanistan under the Russian occupation?
It's not a parallel. It's the direct descendants. Then all Nazi members of the Muslim Brotherhood were used to recruit the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s. That's how the networks of the Mujahideen grew up in London and in the United States. To this day, America is the only Western nation that does not list the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist group. All the European states, even the Arab nations, regard the Muslim Brotherhood as that. But that's because we had this tiny group within American intelligence. We had 10% of American intelligence were recruiting Nazis, while 90% were hunting them.
Now, you've mentioned the Catholics as well. I mean, is it fair to say, do you think, that there are small factions within these faiths, in the Catholic faith and in Islam, that are actually just kind of puppets of the intelligence services?
Yes. Now, I'm Catholic myself, and I think we have to recognize that there was a small group of pro-fascist clerics in Rome that were pro-Nazi. And to a small extent, Pius XII, the Pope during the war, was neutral in favor of Germany. He had been stationed in Germany after World War One, and he was troppo tedeschi, too much the German, the Italians would say.
What about Sullivan and Cromwell, a law firm in the U.S. that was used to launder quite a lot of the Nazi money and gold that was looted in Europe? Do you know anything about them?
I know a great deal about it. Sullivan and Cromwell set up a merger between the British corporation Brown Brothers and the American corporation, the Harrimans. Now, the Harrimans were a democratic family, later governors of New York, ambassadors to Moscow. But it was set up by Herbert Walker, who was the father-in-law of Prescott Bush, who was the father of President 41 and grandfather of President 43. So Herbert Walker put his son-in-law on the board of Brown Brothers Harriman, and quite frankly, we had this American corporation represented by the Dulles brothers in their law firm, and this was the firm that cloaked American and British investment in Germany. Some of America's finest families and Britain's finest families invested in Germany between the wars. It was extremely profitable. And quite frankly, you know, President Teddy Roosevelt had outlawed trusts and monopolies and cartels in America. So these British and American families decided that they would move their money offshore. And they bought the corporate control, if you will, of Germany, Bolshevik Russia, and what became the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Well, two out of three of their investments paid off handsomely. My sense is this stuff was 90% stupidity and only 10% conspiracy. The hardest thing for my friends on both the left and right to accept was that after 30 years with the intelligence files, my conclusion was that it was all about the money. These people funded the infant Bolshevik Party, At the same time, they were funding the infant Nazi party. At the same time, they were funding the birth of the Islamic extremist movement. So they didn't care about ideology. I mean, sharks swim in parallel lines, not because they're in conspiracy, but they're all racing towards the blood in the water.
What about the London bombings? There is a quite an interesting character involved in all that called Haroun Aswat. What do you know about Haroun? Because he's someone who seemed to have almost like a magic ticket to get out of jail.
Yeah, Haroun Aswat was according to the Muslim informants in London, was worked with the British Secret Service. Captain Hook, the imam in London, talked about how his assistant worked with the British Secret Service in some operations in, was it the Balkans or the Crimea, I forget. And anyway, it identified him as an MI6 agent. And of course, when he came to America and tried to recruit people to build a training base in the Northwest, everybody above him and below him was prosecuted by the Americans, but not him. Aswad had the magic get-out-of-jail card. He worked for the British Secret Service. Everywhere he would go, the British would keep him one step ahead of the CIA that were desperately trying to arrest him. It was really comic opera stuff.
But, I mean, you may say comic opera, but quite a lot of people here are concerned because he was in touch with the four alleged bombers on the London bombings back in 2005.
You know, it's funny. Your government brought me over to lecture at an international seminar on money laundering for terrorism. And I was sitting next to someone from Scotland Yard, and he was just insistent that there was no connection between the London bombers and any international terrorist group. And my friend had just, my private investigator had just helped one of your television stations film an American terrorist meeting with the London bombers. You know, it was just absurd. I think there was so much embarrassment about the Arab Nazis, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the outgrowth of these organizations, which were really second-generation members of the old Arab Nazi movement, the Muslim Brotherhood. That's where these kids came from. There was so much embarrassment in Britain that no truthful information was distributed to the police about who they were. The same thing happened in our country. I had a friend go through the CIA's files for the Muslim Brotherhood, and they're almost blank, just a few press clippings. You know, they have no idea of the history of this organization.
That was John Loftus, former US Army officer and Nazi war crimes special prosecutor under former US President Jimmy Carter. He's also author of the new book out on the 1st of January this year, America's Nazi Secret. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. Came in a little bit late, but never mind. Labour councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith. National Vice President also in the second hour of the Public and Commercial Services Union, PCS. Next week, more politics and Mike Birkin's Southwest Friends of the Earth environmental updates.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol